Imagine for a moment that you're a 12-year-old girl. You know, you're just walking home from a neighborhood party.
Right.
It's a crisp autumn evening. You're walking with your brother, and suddenly, just in the blink of an eye, you are dragged into the dark woods.
Yeah, just gone.
Gone. And you do not see your home again for 5 whole years.
Wow.
Instead, you're traded across borders, you're sold to foreign soldiers, and eventually you're forced to walk hundreds of miles through untamed wilderness just to get back to the family that basically assumed you were dead.
Which, I mean, they had every reason to assume, right?
Exactly. And for a child on the American frontier in the late 18th century, this wasn't the plot of some thriller. It was literally just a Tuesday.
It's such a profound reality check, isn't it? Because, you know, when we think of the pioneer days, we tend to really romanticize
Oh,
it.
totally, the whole coonskin cap thing.
Right. We picture this lone frontiersman in a pristine buckskin jacket, just conquering the wild with a compass and a dream. But the actual historical record, it tells a story of constant, just suffocating vulnerability.
And that is exactly our mission for you on this deep dive. We're stripping away all those sanitized Hollywood myths. We want to look at the terrifying, exhausting, and honestly awe-inspiring daily realities of the people who actually lived it.
Yeah, the real daily challenges.
Right. So today we are pulling from 4 deeply personal family histories and service records that were submitted to the DAR.
The Daughters of the American Revolution.
Yes, the DAR. And these documents, they trace the lives of 4 Revolutionary War patriots. We've got James Gage, Peter Roof, Isaac Bowman, and Joseph Ogle.
And what becomes immediately apparent, like the second you start reading these DAR records, is that the American Revolutionary War was not just happening in, you know, polite drawing rooms or on organized battlefields in
Right,
Massachusetts.
it wasn't just guys in lines with muskets.
No, not at all. Out on the frontier, the revolution violently overlapped with these brutal ongoing Indian wars. There was no front line. I mean, the front line was literally your front porch.
I want to start right there, actually,
Yeah.
with the baseline of normal life. Because before we can even talk about, you know, sieges and big battles, we have to understand what it meant to just exist in this environment.
Just to survive the day to day.
Exactly. So the story I mentioned a minute ago about the 12-year-old girl, that's from the records of Peter Roof. The girl was his future wife, Margaret Replogle.
Yeah, and the details of Margaret's kidnapping, they perfectly illustrate how fragile that illusion of safety really was.
Yeah.
Margaret and her brother were attending a husking bee in Pennsylvania.
Okay, a husking bee.
It was essentially an agricultural work party. You
Yeah.
know, neighbors would gather to husk corn, they'd share a meal, socialize.
God.
It was a super vital part of community survival, just preparing food for the winter.
So they're literally doing the most mundane, ordinary chore imaginable.
They really are. But as they walk home, they're intercepted by a raiding party of Native Americans. And her brother somehow manages to slip away.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he sprints the rest of the way home, bursts through his front door, and just collapses on the floor, faints from sheer terror and exhaustion.
I mean, you can't even imagine the panic.
Right. And when he wakes up, he tells them Margaret is gone.
And the family just, they have no recourse. I mean,
Yeah.
there's no police force to call,
No.
there's no search and rescue chopper. She just vanishes. But the records show she wasn't just, you know, wandering the woods aimlessly. She actually became part of this vast, invisible frontier economy.
That is the crucial mechanism to understand here, because captive taking wasn't just random violence, right? It was a deeply ingrained strategic and economic practice.
Okay.
Native American tribes often took captives to replace tribal members who had died from disease or warfare. But as the geopolitical landscape shifted, captives also became currency. Yeah. Over her 5-year ordeal, Margaret was traded among several different tribes, moving further and further away from Pennsylvania until she was eventually sold to the French.
Wait. Why were the French buying a kidnapped teenager from an English colony? Like, was this a ransom situation?
It was actually a tool of imperial warfare
Yeah.
because the French and the British were, you know, constantly vying for control of the continent, and they used Native American tribes as proxy
Oh, I
forces.
see.
Yeah, the French would pay for English captives as a way to encourage raids on British settlements, you know, destabilize the colonial frontier, gather intelligence. Margaret was essentially a pawn in this massive geopolitical chess game played over thousands of miles of wilderness.
That is true.
And she was finally released by the French at Fort Detroit, which is modern-day Michigan, alongside another captive woman and child.
In Michigan?
Yeah. And then the three of them had to slowly walk all the way back to Pennsylvania.
Good Lord. The psychological toll of that is just staggering to me. To realize that your environment is so hostile. You were essentially living in a modern active war zone, but without a military to protect you.
Exactly.
You were your own first responder. So I have to ask, how did anyone sleep? Like, how did communities try to build any kind of defense against that level of constant threat?
Well, they relied on a system of localized piecemeal fortifications. Mm-hmm. And we see the immense, just crushing burden of that system in the DAR records of James Gage.
Okay. Yes, Gage.
Gage was a pioneer living in North Carolina, and his entire adult life reads like an exhausting logistical nightmare.
Yeah, no kidding.
After Native American raids swept through his neighborhood in 1776, the locals frantically built Fort McGaughey. And Gage was drafted into the local militia simply to track movements and try to keep his own neighborhood safe.
And let's break down that word militia, because I feel like it sounds very official, right?
Yeah.
Like a state guard or something.
But, yeah.
But the records specifically note the financial and physical reality of this draft. Mm. On one of his excursions, Gage actually had to supply his own horse, his own saddle, and his own gun.
Exactly, because there was no centralized supply chain for these frontier outposts. I mean, a militia draft meant you had to literally drop your plow, grab whatever weapons you personally owned, and go stand guard in the woods.
Wow.
The economic burden was devastating. If you're drafted to guard a fort, you aren't planting your crops. You aren't hunting for your family. And Gage was continuously uprooting his family, moving them through incredibly rugged terrain from the Carolinas eventually all the way into the Arkansas Territory, just to stay one step ahead of the violence.
And the records mention he was frequently stationed at places like Colonel Earl's blockhouse on the Pacolet River.
Yeah.
What exactly is a blockhouse in this context? Because I'm picturing, I don't know, a tiny fort.
Yeah, it's not a castle, that's for sure. A blockhouse was typically just a stout two-story log cabin built from heavy timber to stop musket balls. The second story usually overhung the first, with small holes, loopholes, cut into the floor and walls. That way the defenders could fire down on anyone trying to set the walls on fire.
Oh, that makes sense.
Yeah. It was a rudimentary wooden box, and honestly, it was often the only thing standing between a pioneer family and total destruction.
And as terrifying as a blockhouse sounds, I mean, it worked against small raiding parties, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But the records show that this piecemeal defense system completely fell apart when the pioneers suddenly faced massive coordinated sieges. Which brings us to this really devastating shift in the frontier reality. Especially around the year 1777.
Yeah, 1777. On the frontier, that year was grimly known as the Year of the Sevens, or simply the Bloody Year.
The Bloody Year.
Because by this point in the American Revolution, the British, who were operating heavily out of Detroit, had allied with numerous Native American tribes, and the British were supplying them with weapons, ammunition, intelligence, okay, turning these localized raids into massive, strategically coordinated military campaigns along the upper Ohio River.
And the DAR records of Captain Joseph Ogle capture this escalation perfectly. Now, the sources describe Ogle as Captain of the Wilderness, mm-hmm, comparing him to a crack shot like Daniel Boone.
Mm-hmm.
But reading the actual events of 1777, the whole Daniel Boone action hero myth just completely evaporates.
It really does.
There's no glory here. It is just raw desperation.
Yeah. So Ogle was commanding a company stationed at Beach Bottom Fort. In September of that bloody year, word arrives that Fort Henry, which is located in present-day downtown Wheeling, West Virginia, is going to be attacked.
Okay.
So Ogle takes a scouting party of 12 men and heads toward Fort Henry to help.
And he notes in the record that he saw smoke on his way in.
Right. And smoke on the frontier is a universal alarm bell.
Definitely.
Well, Captain Samuel Mason, who is already inside Fort Henry, sees the exact same smoke. But Mason assumes it's just a small band of Native Americans burning a cabin. So Mason takes 14 men out to disperse them. Yeah. He walks his men straight into a massive ambush. The Native forces, heavily armed and numbering in the hundreds, slaughter Mason's men. Mason himself is severely wounded, but somehow manages to crawl away to a nearby fort.
So Mason is gone, his men are dead, and Ogle is just arriving with his 12 scouts. What happens to them?
Ogle hears the gunfire, assumes Mason needs help, and just rushes his men forward.
Into the exact same ambush.
Into the exact same ambush. Ogle's 12 men are decimated by heavy crossfire.
And this is the moment that completely dismantled my view of frontier warfare. Because Ogle doesn't shoot his way out like a movie star.
No.
He survives by finding a wounded man, dragging him into a thick patch of high horse weeds, and just lying flat on his stomach in the dirt.
The physical reality of that moment is agonizing to even think about.
Yeah.
You know, you're tangled in the weeds. You have a bleeding man next to you who could groan at any moment.
Yeah.
You're clutching a heavy musket with the hammer cocked, knowing that if you shift your weight or make a single sound, you're dead.
And the source material specifically notes that as Ogle is hiding, two Native American fighters, one of whom is wounded and actively bleeding, come and sit on a wooden fence right next to Ogle's hiding spot.
Literally inches away.
Inches away.
The tension is just suffocating. I mean, Ogle has to lie there absolutely frozen, listening to these men breathe, just waiting for the sun to go down so he can finally drag that wounded man under the cover of darkness back into Fort Henry.
And when he finally gets inside the fort, the nightmare is basically just beginning. Because Mason is gone, so Ogle has to take command of the terrified survivors inside the walls.
Yeah, and the logistics of defending a wooden fort against hundreds of attackers are incredibly complex.
Yeah.
Fort Henry is soon surrounded by an estimated 400 Native Americans, reportedly led by the infamous Loyalist frontiersman Simon Girty.
400?
Right, it's a ferocious hours-long siege. And Ogle realizes quickly that a musket is totally useless if it's empty, and a wooden wall is useless if it's on fire.
Right, so he organizes everyone. The women and children who couldn't fire a heavy weapon from the walls are given a different, equally dangerous job. They're put to work running water and casting bullets.
Because you need a constant stream of water, not just to drink, but to extinguish the flaming arrows hitting the roofs.
Oh, wow.
And to cool down the musket barrels, which would get scorching hot after repeated firing. And, of course, you need a constant stream of lead ammunition.
Just picture that. Picture children sprinting across an open courtyard carrying heavy pails of water and freshly cast lead bullets while musket fire is splintering the wood all around them.
It's unbelievable.
It is. The only reason Fort Henry holds out, the only reason they inflict heavy losses without losing anyone inside the fort during the siege itself, is because of that communal defense.
It's a stark reminder that survival was a collective effort. But you know, the communal toll was still devastating. Shortly after surviving the siege of Fort Henry, Ogle's brother, Jacob, was killed in another massive ambush known to history as Foreman's Defeat.
Jeez.
The violence simply did not stop.
Right. And as terrifying as defending a fixed position like a fort was,
yeah,
the records reveal something even more unnerving.
Oh, definitely.
Because moving through this lawless wilderness exposed these pioneers to fates that were so chaotic, they almost defy belief. And this brings us to Isaac Bowman. His story proves that out on the frontier, the rules of reality could just change on a dime.
Isaac Bowman's life requires us to rethink basically everything we assume about frontier identity. He was born into a prominent pioneer family in Virginia. In 1753, his parents built this prestigious limestone house.
Like an absolute fortress of a home.
Yes, which they officially named Fort Bowman.
But the family nicknamed it Harmony Hall.
Right.
And it was a deeply sarcastic nickname.
Yeah.
Because Mary Bowman had 13 children, and the older siblings referred to the youngest boys as the seven wild Bowman boys.
I love that detail.
Right. So calling this packed, chaotic limestone house Harmony Hall was incredibly tongue-in-cheek.
Completely. So Isaac was the youngest of those 13. At age 11, his father dies, and Isaac inherits the limestone house and a vast tract of land.
Wow, at 11.
Yeah. He's set up for a life of landed Virginia gentry, but the Revolutionary War pulls him in. As a young man, Isaac becomes a quartermaster or a purser for the military out in the distant Illinois Territory.
Which means his job was high-stakes logistics. Mm-hmm. He was responsible for carrying the physical currency used to buy military supplies for the troops.
Yes. So in late 1779, he's traveling down the Ohio River with several families, and they're using a bateau boat.
Okay, a bateau, just so we're clear.
It's a large, flat-bottomed riverboat. They were essential for moving heavy cargo, but they were incredibly difficult to maneuver, making them sitting ducks for anyone watching from the dense forest on the riverbanks.
Ah, gotcha.
And sure enough, the boat is ambushed by a war party of Chickasaw Indians. It's a total massacre. Every man on the boat is killed or captured, except for one single survivor who manages to escape into the woods.
And that survivor makes it all the way back to Virginia and reports to the Bowman family that Isaac is dead.
Exactly. And his family mourns him for 3 years.
But Isaac wasn't dead.
No, he wasn't. During the chaos of the ambush, he somehow had the presence of mind to take the quartermaster's purse full of military funds and hide it in the brush along the riverbank.
That is insane.
And then he's captured by the war party.
I mean, my analogy for this is it's like a glitchy video game where the rules keep radically changing. You go from doing military inventory on a boat to being a prisoner of war, subjected to torture, and sitting in a camp waiting to be executed.
It's a total paradigm shift. But then the captive economy we discussed earlier takes a different turn here.
Right.
A prominent chief's wife steps forward. She has recently lost her own son in battle, and under their cultural traditions, she claims Isaac to replace her dead son.
Wow.
Yeah, her intervention halts the execution.
I want to pause on that because we often think of identities as fixed, you know, but Isaac Bowman had to become a chameleon to survive.
Absolutely.
He had to shed his identity as a Virginia landowner, shed his identity as a military accountant, and just step into the role of an adopted captive son.
He had no choice. The ecosystem demanded it. He's assimilated into the tribe. He's even forced to marry the chief's daughter, a woman named Wawa Seneki.
Right.
He lives in their shelter. He eats with them. He's technically family, but he is fundamentally a prisoner who could be killed if he displeases his captors.
Honestly, it sounds like an exaggerated frontier legend. Like, if someone told you this story at a dinner party, you'd assume they were making it up.
Oh, for sure.
But the historical proof of this is one of the most astonishing things in the DAR records.
It really is. The corroboration comes decades later from an entirely different historical source.
Yeah.
In 1805, Meriwether Lewis and William Clark are making their legendary expedition across the continent, and William Clark records in his journal that they encountered a group of Native American women. He notes that one older woman had a highly unusual marking.
She had a tattoo on her left arm, done in berry juice, and the tattoo read, "Ibo Man."
It is just an incredible piece of evidence.
Think about the mindset of Isaac Bowman in that moment. He's sitting in a shelter hundreds of miles from Virginia. He knows he might never see his family again. He takes a sharp stick and berry juice, and he pricks his name into his new wife's arm.
Yeah.
Like, was it a distress signal, hoping another traitor would see it? Or was he just trying to leave a permanent mark on the world, a desperate attempt to prove that Isaac Bowman still existed?
It's heartbreaking. But whatever his intention, we know he never stopped looking for a way out. He eventually attempts to escape his captivity, but is tracked down and recaptured.
Oh, man.
He's tortured a second time and once again faces certain execution. But his life is saved by yet another bizarre twist of frontier economics. A Spanish-speaking trader happens to be passing through the territory. He sees Isaac and decides to buy his life.
And the price for a human life, a Virginia landowner and military quartermaster, was a single keg of rum.
A single keg of rum. And the trader takes ownership of Isaac and transports him all the way to Cuba.
The geographical whiplash is just stunning. You go from the Ohio River Basin to an indigenous tribe to being a traded commodity, and suddenly you're in the Spanish Caribbean.
Right. And the prevailing theory is that he was taken to Cuba to recover from his extensive torture injuries, or perhaps he was forced to work off the debt of the keg of rum that bought his life. We don't have the exact details of his time in Cuba, but we know he survives that too.
Unbelievable.
He secures passage back to the American colonies.
And this is the detail that proves just how ironclad his sheer willpower was. He doesn't just go home. He travels back up the Ohio River, finds the exact spot of the massacre from 3 years earlier, digs through the brush, and finds the quartermaster's purse he had hidden.
It's wild.
He takes that money and returns it to the Virginia authorities, complete with his ledgers.
It's an unparalleled display of duty. In 1782, 3 years after he was declared dead, Isaac Bowman walks up the steps of the limestone house they jokingly called Harmony Hall, very much alive.
When you synthesize these four lives gauge, Roof, Ogle, and Bowman, it really forces a massive shift in how we view the founding of the country.
It does.
We spent so much time in history class focusing on the philosophies, the political debates in Philadelphia, the signing of declarations. But these DAR records reveal the actual foundation of the nation wasn't just ink on parchment. It was sheer, unimaginable physical endurance.
They absorbed the chaos of an actively hostile ecosystem, and they just kept building. Isaac Bowman took over his plantation, eventually had two marriages, and raised 15 children.
And James Gage, the man who spent his life endlessly marching, buying his own horses, and guarding rudimentary wooden blockhouses. He lived to be an old blind man in Arkansas. He sat down and dictated his memories to a traveling justice of the peace, ensuring his service wouldn't be erased by time.
And Peter Roof, the man whose wife Margaret survived 5 years as a traded captive before walking back from Michigan. Peter lived a long, full life and eventually became the very first person buried in his town's new cemetery in South Bend, Indiana.
The raw DNA of survival in these records is humbling. And the next time you are faced with the seemingly insurmountable challenge in your own life, I mean, I don't want you to compare it to the frontier because thankfully we don't live in an active war zone.
Right, right.
But I do want you to remember the immense capacity of the human spirit that you descend from. You come from a species capable of surviving the unthinkable, shedding identities to adapt, and walking hundreds of miles just to find home.
It provides a really profound sense of perspective.
It does. But as we close this deep dive, there is one final haunting detail from the sources that I want you to mull over. We talked about Captain Joseph Ogle, the captain of the Wilderness, who hid in the horse weeds, holding his breath while his enemies sat inches away.
Yeah, a man whose tactics and leadership kept hundreds of people alive during the siege of Fort Henry.
Right. Well, the original DAR documents mention a tragic footnote about his legacy. Much of Ogle's history, his firsthand accounts, the intricate details of his daily survival and military tactics, was gathered by an early historian named Reverend J.W. Peck. And Peck was writing a comprehensive book about Ogle's life. But before it could be published, Peck's house caught fire. All of those invaluable notes, all those meticulously recorded memories, went up in smoke.
They were completely erased from the historical record in an afternoon.
It makes you wonder about the terrifying fragility of history itself. You know, how much of this incredible frontier saga has simply vanished. How many other men and women survived agonizing sieges, endured years of captivity, or navigated unbelievable chaos, only for their stories to burn in a parlor fire?
Exactly.
We are left with just the slimmest paper trails, an old pension application dictated by a blind man, a mention in a town cemetery log, or a name pricked in berry juice on a woman's arm to prove these unimaginable lives even happened. When you realize how close we came to knowing nothing at all about the true cost of the frontier, that pristine Hollywood movie set doesn't just burn down, it blows away in the wind.